Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. 2 weeks ago, we aired a special hour-long interview with Congressman John Katko discussing the new tax law. And you can find that conversation on WRVO.org under the local programming tab. Today is a follow-up of sorts to that conversation. My guest is Len Berman. He's the Paul Volcker Professor at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University and the co-founder of the Tax Policy Center, a joint project of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. He's been on the program previously discussing prior tax initiatives. My conversation with Len will have two parts. We'll air the second part next week, so if you don't get all your questions answered today, come back to us again. Len, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Grant.
Now, I imagine that most of our listeners are familiar by this point with the basic contours of the new law, but I think it does help to start with an overview. So could you just start by giving me a brief synopsis of this new law?
Sure. The bill cuts tax rates, maybe not surprisingly. The top individual rate would be cut from 39.6% to 37%. The business tax rate would, or tax rate on corporations, would be cut from 35% to 21%. There's a special new deduction for so-called pass-through businesses. These are partnerships and sole proprietorships and things like that. Company and such businesses will be able to deduct 20% of their income from tax. It trims the alternative minimum tax. It used to hit a lot of middle-income people. It won't under this bill, but it's still in the law, which is a little bit annoying. It almost doubles the standard deduction to $24,000 for a couple and half that for individuals. It eliminates personal and dependent exemptions, those deductions you get for yourself and your kids. It doubles the child tax credit, which was $1,000, and it will be $2,000, although the portion available for low-income people who don't have enough tax liability to use the whole credit will only be $1,400 initially, although that will increase slowly over time. It limits state and local tax deductions to $10,000. Previously, you could deduct income and property taxes on an unlimited basis. It limited for new homes that are bought. It limits the amount of mortgage debt. It had been $1.1 million you could deduct, and it will be limited to $1.1 million you could take a mortgage on and deduct all the interest. It'll limit that to $750,000. Leaves capital gains tax rates the same. It changes the way we adjust for inflation in the tax brackets and other parameters. Previously, we used the Consumer Price Index, and under the new law, they're going to use something called the chained CPI, which is an economist's idea, but basically it says it means that inflation adjustments will be slower than they'd be otherwise. That might have implications for other laws too, although that might be on the to-do list down the road. One of the interesting things about the law is that it phases out almost everything after 2025. So all the individual income tax cuts are eliminated in 2026, although that slower inflation indexing is a permanent feature. So unless Congress changes the law, a lot of people's taxes are going to go up that year. And most of the business provisions also end in 2025, but the 21% corporate tax rate is permanent. The last thing is that it changes the way we tax multinational businesses. And basically, income earned overseas will be forever exempt from U.S. tax. There's some limits on that. And there will be a tax on current profits held by foreign companies or untaxed profits held by foreign companies. They will be collected over the next few years. But then multinationals will basically, all of their foreign income will be exempt from tax. And there are also some limits on interest. So those are the big features. The bill is 600 pages long, and to be honest, I did not read the whole thing because I have other ways to get to sleep at night.
Well, even that brief synopsis illustrates something that we're going to unpack here, and that's there are a lot of moving parts to this thing, and we're going to dig into many of the things that you just mentioned. But let me stay with the overall picture here for a minute and kind of ask the bottom line question to you, and then we'll come back and work through some of these. But what I wanted to ask right away is, What are your biggest concerns about the law overall, the effects that it's going to have? What are the things that are most disturbing to you about it?
Actually, I just realized I left out two big pieces.
So okay. Maybe
two things.
Those are the things that bother you. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, among the things that bother me, it doubles the exemption level for the estate tax. It had been $11 million for a couple. It'll be $22 million under the new law, at least for the next 8 years. And they did a little bit of health revision as part of tax reform. This has been widely reported, but it eliminates the individual mandate penalty.
Right.
And, you know, it's not a tax provision, but it is obviously concerning because, you know, one of the key features of the Affordable Care Act was that everyone could get insurance for the same rate. And the only way that really works is if people have to buy insurance, if you can't just wait to get insurance until you get sick. This eliminating the individual mandate ends that and basically allows people who are healthy to just, you know, take their chances and buy insurance when they get sick. That means that health insurance premiums are going to go up. It's not a big problem for people who get subsidized insurance under in the health insurance marketplaces, but for people with higher incomes, over 400% of poverty, their premiums are going to go up pretty significantly. Mm. The other thing, it's kind of interesting, and the thing that worries a lot of health experts is that a lot of people found out they were eligible for Medicaid when they went to get insurance in the exchanges, thinking they had to buy it, and that's clearly a service to lower income people who thought they couldn't afford insurance. And that will be ended once people don't think they have to get insurance anymore and they're not being pushed to go to the exchanges. You know, the big thing, the bill adds $1.5 trillion to deficits over the next decade, more if those expiring provisions are extended, as Congress says it intends to do. That doesn't make any sense right now. Right now, our debt is 77% of GDP, more than three-quarters the size of our economy, and it's growing. According to CBO, we're going to add $10 trillion in deficits over the next decade if nothing changed. So this adds another $1.5 trillion or more. It also doesn't make any sense as fiscal policy. When the economy is weak, it makes sense for the government to spend more money as a way to boost the economy in the short run. But our economy is very close to full employment. The unemployment rate is 4.1% right now. It doesn't make any sense for the government to be pumping more money in right now. And there's a risk that it could push up interest rates or inflation. And even, you know, counterintuitively, it might even push us into recession sooner than we might go otherwise. The other thing is that the benefits are very tilted to high-income people. It's true that most people would pay lower taxes under the law until 2025, but the biggest tax cuts go to people in the top 1%, top 1/10 of 1%. In 2018, the average tax cut for somebody in the middle of the income distribution was about $900. For somebody in the top 0.1%, it's $193,000. And I don't think anybody thinks the problem with our economy is that it's not rewarding high-income people enough right now. The big problem is wage stagnation and the fact that low- and middle-income people feel like they're really falling behind. The other thing is it really missed a chance to do serious reform. It creates a giant new loophole. The 20% deduction for pass-through businesses is going to encourage all sorts of abuse. Kansas had something like this, where they exempted pass-through businesses from their state income tax, which was like a 6% tax. And it didn't do anything to encourage job creation. It did produce a lot of people who said that they were self-employed or LLCs, but that was just a way for them to avoid tax. In Kansas, the highest-paid public employee, Bill Self, who's the coach of the Kansas Jayhawks basketball team, had an LLC. And almost all of his income was tax-free under the provision. It worked out so badly for Kansas that the Republican legislature voted to eliminate the special break for pass-throughs. And then when the governor vetoed it, they overrode his veto. It was a disaster, and we've decided to do that at the national level. It makes no sense.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Len Berman, a professor at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University and co-founder of the Tax Policy Center. So two of the things there that you highlighted at the beginning was the effect of this on the deficit and the national debt, and then also the effects on inequality. And then there are a lot of other things in there. Let me ask you, as a follow-up, are there other concerns that you have about incentives or disincentives it creates? You talked about the pass-through income and the experience in Kansas, but I've also read some things about concerns about charitable contributions and the housing market, purchasing of houses. What are some of the incentives or disincentives the law creates there?
Yeah, so by raising the standard deduction and by limiting the state and local tax deduction, many, many fewer people will itemize their deductions. And the way it worked until last year was that you added up, if you had the choice of adding up deductions for charity, mortgage interest, state and local taxes, a few other things, and if those were more than the standard deduction, which was $13,000 for a household, then you could itemize your deductions. And so a lot of people got a subsidy for making donations to charity, for owning a home. Well, the number of itemizers is going to fall by 27 million people in 2018. It'll be a very small fraction of the tax-paying population, maybe like 10% of tax filers. And only those people will have any tax incentive to give to charity. Now, I know that people give to charity for other reasons, but there's a lot of economic evidence that people respond to the tax break. Millionaires and billionaires will still get a tax break on their contributions to charity, and that's great for them. It's great for places like Syracuse University because millionaires like to give to universities and arts institutions and things like that. But low and middle-income people give to religious institutions and social welfare organizations, and very few of them will have any tax incentive to give. So there's a concern that there might be a big drop-off on charitable giving. The other thing, the estate tax doesn't help either. By doubling the exemption for the estate tax, many fewer people will be subject to that tax that's levied at death on your assets. And the biggest tax break for the estate tax is on donations to charity. You could save. When you get those letters from your alma mater saying, hey, consider planned giving, they are eager to tell you about all the tax breaks you can get under the income tax and the estate tax that give you, that basically lower the cost of making a big gift to your alma mater. But you and I are safe forever from that provision. We probably were even under the old rules, but they keep on raising the exemption level for the estate tax and reduces the incentive to give. Also, it makes it a lot easier for families to accumulate enormous amounts of wealth without ever being subject to tax. There are other kinds of incentives that are problematic. The international provisions are intended to make American companies more competitive in the world markets. Most of our competitors, other countries, also exempt foreign income from tax. But the concern is that there are ways that companies can abuse this, that instead of, picking the best country in which to produce things, which we're hoping would be the United States, there's still a very, very strong incentive for companies to move their economic activities to places with very, very low taxes, like the Cayman Islands or Ireland or things like that, and play accounting games to avoid their tax liability. So some experts are concerned that instead of bringing jobs back to the United States, making it more attractive for companies to be headquartered here, that actually U.S. companies will have more ways of moving their economic activity overseas to avoid U.S. tax.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Len Berman. He's the Paul Volcker Professor at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University and co-founder of the Tax Policy Center. We're discussing the new tax law. Well, in the first half, Len, you gave quite an extensive list of concerns that you have about the new law and different kinds of incentives that it might create. I was just curious, on the other side, is there any change from the status quo that's contained in this new law that you endorse?
Yeah, there there's some revisions that make sense. I mean, I think cutting marginal tax rates, if you did it in a way that didn't blow a hole in the deficit, would make sense. Broadening the base, so you tax more income in the same way rather than having special tax breaks for one kind of activity or another thing, would be a good thing. They didn't do much base broadening, but they did lower rates. Having a 21% corporate tax rate is probably lower than we needed to go relative to our foreign competitors, but we did have the highest corporate tax rate in the world, at least among rich countries. There are some dumb provisions of prior law that were eliminated, some kinds of phase-outs, complicated phase-outs on itemized deductions and personal exemptions, which I guess are gone. The AMT, the individual AMT should have been eliminated. It just doesn't make sense to have two different tax systems for people to go through. But they raise the threshold so much that it only will apply to people who are very wealthy. So I guess that makes it a little bit better. The debate that was going into it was I enjoyed it. The conservatives particularly in the primary were talking about serious conservative proposals that were going to boost economic incentives for companies to produce more and more efficiently. And they weren't necessarily the kinds of tax systems that I would have proposed, but I thought it was exactly the kind of thing that people should talk about. Hmm. Unfortunately, most of the serious reform proposals didn't make it into the final bill. What they did, they have kind of this hodgepodge where, like, they allow companies to immediately deduct the cost of new investments, which makes sense if you think we should move away from taxing income and towards taxing spending. But they also allow a deduction for interest, which they limit, but it doesn't actually make sense to allow companies to both deduct interest costs and immediately deduct the full cost of new equipment investments.
I see.
The concern is that this bill is going to produce a lot of new tax shelters, but that also might be a silver lining. People like to compare this bill to the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which I worked on as a junior staffer at the Treasury. I don't think it's the right analogy. The right analogy is the Economic Recovery Tax Act of 1981 that Ronald Reagan passed right after he took office, which created a huge wave of tax shelters, so-called see-through office buildings that investors could make money from just because of the tax breaks, even without any tenants. And I think we might see something like that coming out of this, and it could be that it'll upset people so much that they'll actually favor real tax reform down the road, which presumably another president would preside over.
Yeah, I want to.
So I'm working on the Tax Reform Act of 2022 right now.
Okay, all right. I want to ask you next week another question about that 1981 set of tax cuts. Mm. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Len Berman from the Maxwell School and the Tax Policy Center. But right now, what I want to do is I want to come back to something you said earlier when you were listing concerns, and that was basically the effect on inequality. You talked about the different absolute amounts of tax breaks that people at different income levels would get. And it does seem pretty non-controversial to say that, on the whole, this tax law is going to increase inequality in a country where the levels are already at historic highs. So I wanted to put something to you. I mentioned at the outset that I talked 2 weeks ago to a local member of Congress here who voted for the tax bill. He had concerns, but he voted for it. And I pushed him on the inequality issue. And the gist of his response, and I think I'm doing justice to it here, was this, that while it's true that the wealthy would see a larger tax deduction in absolute terms, the ultimate problem there in terms of inequality in recent decades has been the structure of wages and income. And he juxtaposed that with his sense that the amount of tax relief for middle-class families would be, although smaller in absolute terms, create some real qualitative differences in some of those families' finances that they would feel and benefit from and be able to make different decisions based on. So that's how he weighed this. How do you react to that kind of argument and thinking about the impact of the law?
Kind of reminds me of Treasury Secretary Mnuchin saying that middle-income people could buy a new car with their tax cut. And I just love the idea of Steve Mnuchin driving around in his $930 car, guessing that his wife wouldn't want to sit in it with him. The argument that some conservatives make is that by encouraging a lot of investment, that it'll push up wages. Kevin Hassett, who's the president's chief economist, said he thought wages would go up by $4,000 on average. A couple of problems with that. One is that even if it went up by $4,000 on average, that most of the wage increase would probably go at the very top. But the other thing is it assumes that companies make a lot of investment in technology that makes workers more productive, and that shows up in their wages. There probably will be a little bit of that, and our analysis of the bill assumes that wages would go up a little bit. But mostly this bill is tilted towards new investment, corporate profits, and a lot of that investment is not going to it's not going to make workers more productive, but actually it could hasten the pace of investing in technology that that substitutes for workers, robots and less high tech, self-driving cars and trucks and automated cashiers at the grocery store. I think the big problem that most economists have identified with inequality is that the nature of technology is mostly benefiting people at the very, very top. The people who own the machines are doing very, very well, whereas the workers who are trying to compete with the machines are having trouble. Now, I don't think we're all going to be replaced by robots soon, but I don't think the trend where automation puts downward pressure on wages is going to change anytime soon. And you think about, suppose you had taken that $1.5 trillion and invested it in more education and training and helping workers get to the places where there are good new jobs. That could do a lot more to help middle-income workers, find good jobs that would pay them decent wages than providing big tax cuts for businesses and hoping that somehow that would translate into higher wages for rank-and-file workers.
I was wondering if you thought, and again, the tax bill as a whole has these implications for different income levels, different economic classes, and also thinking of the state and local provision and other provisions, family setup and geography, where people are living. I wanted to know, what do you think that an awareness of those sub-patterns and its impact in terms of politics, in terms of political strategy, thinking about both who do you want to reward, who might you not reward, or how will this play out down the road? Was that part of the thinking in putting this bill together? I know that's a complicated question, but I wanted to get your sense of that.
Yeah, I think it was. There are a whole bunch of big tax breaks that Congress could have taken on, and the only really big one that they trimmed significantly was the deduction for state and local taxes. And I think there's a perception that that mostly benefits blue states, and actually the perception is right. If you look at the data, New York, California, Connecticut, New Jersey, D.C., those are places that benefit the most from the state and local tax deduction, both because they have higher taxes than average and because they have people with incomes that are higher than the national average. So initially the House wanted to eliminate the state and local tax deduction altogether. Mm-hmm. And ultimately they allowed a $10,000 deduction. But that's going to hit a lot of the people who are listening to this broadcast. There are good reasons for limiting the state and local tax deduction. It mostly does benefit high-income people. It's one provision that makes the tax law less regressive than it would be otherwise. But there are also concerns about it. If you think that the next step after this law is that we're going to cut spending, then that means that more responsibilities are going to be shifted to state and local governments. And without the deduction, or with a limited deduction, there's a concern that taxpayers will be less inclined to take on the burden of paying for additional services the government isn't providing without the tax break, and that's a worry.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that later, but I think it's a good time to do it. So there is this concern that this might have this real constraining effect on states, and as you point out, perhaps exactly at the moment where they need to have the most flexibility and ability to take on new spending. The governor in the state of New York, Andrew Cuomo, he's floated the idea of making changes to the state income tax to make it still qualify as a federal deduction, including turning the income tax into a payroll tax. We only have a couple minutes left in today's program, but if you could get into that, how complicated is that and how problematic would that kind of change be?
I don't like it personally, since I earn income in New York and also in Virginia, and I currently get a credit for my New York taxes against my Virginia tax liability, and I don't think that would happen if it was a payroll tax. Mm. I think, you know, there are a lot of ideas floated around there about how to get around the limit. They could make things more complicated. They could have unintended consequences. And there's also a concern that if Congress really intended to make New Yorkers pay higher taxes, that they'll just say, well, the payroll tax isn't, you know, it's not going to be included in your income anyway. Mm. So it's even possible. I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, it's not clear to me that the courts would rule that payroll tax to be legitimately treated as a payroll tax and not an income tax. So I think there's some risks to that.
Well, that's all we have time for today. But again, we will continue this conversation next week. There's still a lot more to unpack here in this new tax law. That was Len Berman. Len, I want to thank you for talking with me.
Thanks. It's always fun.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest. Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Last week, I started a conversation about the new tax law with tax expert Len Berman. And this week, we continue that conversation. You can find last week's program at WRVO.org under the Local Programming tab. Len Berman is the Paul Volcker Professor at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University and the co-founder of the Tax Policy Center, a joint project of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. Len, thanks for coming back on the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
We started last week with you providing a brief synopsis of the law, and I think it makes sense for our listeners who missed that to hear, you know, maybe even a shorter version of that. But start us off with a brief synopsis, and then what I want to do is get into some of the individual provisions that we didn't have time to talk about last week.
Sure. So the bill is it's a $1.5 trillion tax cut over the next 10 years. It cuts top individual tax rates from 39.6 to 37%, corporate tax rates from 35 to 21%. There's a big tax cut for so-called pass-through businesses. There's a higher child tax credit, which goes from $1,000 to $2,000, but people lose personal exemptions. And there are a number of loss deductions. It doubles the estate tax exemption. It changes the way the tax law adjusts for inflation, so actually the inflation adjustments would be a little bit slower, which would tend to push people into higher brackets. And it also repeals the individual mandate under the Affordable Care Act.
Thanks. So let me get into some of these things. And last week we ended by talking about the state and local tax deduction and the broader implications of that and whether states could figure out workarounds around that and the problems with them. I wanted to back up, though, and ask you this question more philosophically, and that is the new law limits these deductions, but they were still preserved. What is the argument in the first place, though, to have a deduction for state and local property and income taxes in the federal tax code? I mean, why should the federal government be subsidizing the taxing and the spending by states in the first place? Shouldn't citizens in those states be paying the real cost of those right out of the gate and have a more honest conversation in each state about what the state is doing?
Well, that's the argument for eliminating the deduction. The argument against it is that it's kind of double taxation, that you pay if you have to pay tax to your state and local government, you don't have that money available to pay federal taxes as well. And you could imagine that, you know, it's an extreme case, but if the federal government took 100% of your income, you'd have no money to pay your federal taxes, so obviously you should be allowed to deduct it. Fortunately, New York is still pretty far short of that, although there's always a sense that they're heading in that direction.
Right. Well, so there's a piece we haven't talked about then. We'll put the state and local behind us for a minute. The tax break for carried interest, I understand, did not get cut, and it was something that the president wanted to see happen. He wanted to see that dealt with as a candidate. What is that tax break, and why is it a concern, and why is it still in there?
So there are some kinds of businesses, private equity businesses, where you buy companies and reorganize them and sell them at a profit, and hedge funds, where the people who put together those deals get a large part of their compensation in the form of capital gains. So basically, if they're able to sell their reorganized business at a profit, that the profit, instead of being treated as wages and salaries or compensation, is treated as capital gains. And under the law, capital gains are taxed at a top rate of 20% versus now 37% for ordinary income. So there's basically a big subsidy for really, really rich people who do these deals, and there's good reason to get rid of that tax break. The ironic thing is that I think a lot of the people who are in this business actually got an additional tax break under the law because they're partnerships and they qualify for the 20% deduction of their income from tax under the special provision. So they're actually going to pay lower taxes. So even though the president said he wanted to get rid of the carried interest loophole, and there are both Republicans and I think virtually all Democrats who would agree with him, somehow it didn't make it into the law.
Now, you last week referenced the tax cut in 1981 in Ronald Reagan's first term. And I wanted to ask you a more specific question about that particular piece of legislation and another one that strikes me also as in the same vein. And I wanted you to think about this from the standpoint of the middle class. And maybe you might want to provide what a definition of that, because in the United States, people mean different things when they say that. But from the standpoint of what we would regard as the middle class, how does this tax law that's just been passed compare with some of the other large-scale tax cuts in our recent history? So let's think about, and if you want to add another one in there, go ahead. But I wasn't thinking so much of the reorganization of the tax code in 1986, but I was thinking of the tax cut, again, in Ronald Reagan's first term, 1981, and then the other one that George W. Bush got through in his first term as well. How does this one stack up for the middle class in that regard?
It's certainly true that both the 81 tax cut and President Bush's tax cuts in 2001 through 2003 were also very tilted towards high-income people. They did more... I'm having trouble remembering the details of the 81 Act. I was in grad school at that point. But the 2001-2003 tax cuts in the Bush administration did more to help lower-income working people than this law does. For example, in 2003, President Bush made the child tax credit partially refundable. I mean, actually... There was a little bit that was refundable before, but what it means is that low-income working people who don't have enough income tax liability to use the $1,000 child tax credit would be able to get it in excess of their tax liability if they had enough earnings, and that was a pretty significant benefit for you know, somebody earning the minimum wage who was trying to support a child or two. I don't even remember. Well, the 81, I don't really remember what the 81 Act did for low-income people. It did a lot for people with high incomes. It cut capital gains tax rates, and it cut the top rate from 70% to 50%. Partly, you know, you could see a kind of political dynamic where we kind of yo-yo between more progressive and less progressive laws. Mm. But if you look at the data over the last 30 years, the tax burdens, the income tax burdens, at all levels have gone down as a share of income, but at the very top, the income tax burden has gone down more as a percentage of income than for middle and lower income people.
Hmm. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Lynn Berman, a professor at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University and co-founder of the Tax Policy Center. Another provision we didn't talk about last week, earlier versions of this bill, didn't make it into the final law, but earlier versions had a set of provisions regarding the tax status of graduate tuition waivers, undergraduate tuition remission, and private activity bonds, which amounted in total to many observers as tantamount to a war on higher education. Why were those provisions in there in the first place, do you think? Was there any kind of political calculation or some sense of payback at the academy? One might see that.
Yeah, I don't really know what the political motivations are. There's definitely a concern that among Republicans in particular, there seems to be a decline in support for higher education. And I think they have a perception that universities are these elitist liberal institutions that are indoctrinating children with bad kinds of thinking. I'm hoping that's not what was the motivation for the proposals you were mentioning. And there are some, there are economic arguments for how tuition waivers or tuition assistance might be considered as income, although I didn't think the way they implemented it really made much sense. There's definitely a concern about it. I mean, one thing is a little bit ironic is that the bill really focused on lowering the cost of investment in new equipment, but an economist would argue that investment in human capital, people's brains and their skills and abilities, is also worth encouraging, and especially in the new economy where you've got to be able to do things that machines can't do. And that seemed to get short shrift in this bill.
And many observers have advanced another kind of concern that this law is basically the first shoe to drop when it comes to economic policy, and that the other shoe is that there will now be a greater need to cut back on entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid due to the reductions in income for the government, basically. And some Republican leaders in Congress have made statements that, these programs need to be reformed. And so how do you see those two things going together? I mean, does it make sense to link this new tax law with these other big pieces of what government does and to think that there's going to be an important effect on the politics surrounding programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid?
Yeah, I think I mean, clearly Paul Ryan has been very clear in that he wants to make significant cuts to both entitlements and to a lot of discretionary spending programs that benefit low and middle income people. You could argue that by adding to our deficits one argument you make is, well, obviously they've shown they don't care about deficits, so maybe we don't have to worry about these other programs. But my guess is that they're going to say, well, look at the projections now. We've got $11 or $12 trillion of additional debt that will be incurred over the next decade unless we change policy, made significantly worse by the tax cuts, and therefore it's more urgent than ever to deal with entitlements. But the bill could make it harder to do that, though, because it does make sense to take on entitlement programs, particularly health spending, because they're on an unsustainable trajectory. The combination of the aging of baby boomers and the fact that healthcare costs keep on growing faster than the rest of the economy means we've got to figure out a way to cut our spending, maybe try to get it more in line with spending in other developed countries. But the only way to do that is on a bipartisan basis. It's so easy to demagogue cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and the Democrats would be very enthusiastic about doing this right after they felt like they were completely shut out of the process on tax reform. So I think ironically it could make it harder to deal with these problems rather than easier. And I think a lot of Republicans are going to be feeling politically vulnerable in the next election. And Senate Majority Leader McConnell has already said that he doesn't even want to try to touch Medicare, although Paul Ryan would still like to do it. The other thing is that the bill did set the stage for one obvious, or for one change that would cut spending on Social Security, which is if they decided to adopt the slower inflation index for Social Security that they put in place for the tax law. And there is an economic argument that it's a better measure of inflation. The basic idea is that it accounts for the fact that when price of one good goes up a lot and another good doesn't change very much, that people will substitute to the cheaper good. The problem is that if you look at how price changes affect the elderly, as people get older, their spending goes up and up because they have to spend more on health care. And slower inflation indexing could be a real problem for the very old who are dependent on Social Security, who are already the most likely to be in poverty, even with Social Security program.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Len Berman. He's the Paul Volcker Professor at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University and co-founder of the Tax Policy Center. And we're discussing the new tax law. Let's look ahead to different possible political futures here for the country. Thinking about this tax law, what parts of this law do you think would survive a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress if that were to come about?
The higher standard deduction, the higher child tax credit. I would guess that the child tax credit would be made fully refundable for people with enough earnings. Right now, it's limited to about $1,400. I mean, I'm sure there's some other provisions, but those are the things that most benefit people with low and middle incomes. You know, some of the lower tax rates that apply to people with middle incomes would be preserved, I assume.
It was my sense, too, and I want to look backward now and then look forward, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my sense in my political memory that the 1986 reorganization of the tax code kind of had a freezing effect on major changes to the federal tax code thereafter. And I was wondering whether you thought this legislation might have the same kind of effect, that you know, when the topic comes up of we need to deal with X or we need to deal with Y in the tax system, the response might be, look, you know, we did that in 2017. You know, we're not going back there again.
Well, it probably would put the brakes on future tax cuts for a while. The thing about the 86 Act was that it was revenue neutral. It didn't increase deficits, and it was permanent. So the Congress wasn't required to look reevaluate the law at any particular point in the future, although there were some provisions that were put in place on a temporary basis. Congress actually is considering another tax bill right now, which is a number of provisions in the law expire every few years, and Congress typically just extends them for 1 or 2 years at a time. It's actually kind of a budget gimmick. It makes it look like they're less expensive than they are. But the other thing is, in 2025, all of the individual provisions and a lot of the business provisions expire. So Congress is going to have to consider what to do about that.
Let me ask you that if I could jump in. Yeah. How likely do you think it would be that those provisions that are going to expire, those cuts that are going to expire, that they would be left to rise? That would seem to me like, regardless Democrat or Republican, a pretty tough political lift to say, you know, we're just not going to pass anything and these rates are all going to go up. I would assume that they would just keep, as you said, you know, extending them by some set of years, you know, over and over again.
Yeah, they'll probably extend the low and middle income provisions. The concern is that, you know, if they couldn't afford to extend the tax cuts to 2026 now, or in 2017, given the budget projections at that point, if the debt situation is even worse in 2025 now than it is now, people might, you know, they the real political question, I probably should flip this back to you since you're the political scientist, but when do people start being concerned about deficits and debt?
Yeah, I think that question has not been answered. I don't think anybody's ever won an election on that. Ross Perot got some traction, but yeah, it's a good point.
So the interesting thing, you mentioned the 81 tax cuts. Ronald Reagan rolled those back significantly in 82, 83, and 84. And the reason he did it wasn't that he thought that they were bad policy per se, but because interest rates were really, really high and he was getting pressure from businesses to cut the deficit because they thought that would put down, that would reduce the pressure on interest rates. So as long as interest rates are at historic lows where they are now, there's really very little pressure to do anything about the debt. But if interest rates start going up and people think there's a connection between our very large debt and the interest rates that not only government but individuals are paying, that could create some pressure to both cut spending and raise taxes.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Len Berman from the Maxwell School and the Tax Policy Center. Now, there's disagreements among the pundits right now as to whether this law is going to help or hurt Republicans in 2018 in the midterm elections and then in 2020 in the presidential election. What's your sense of this? I mean, recognizing we obviously don't know for sure right now, but what's your sense of how this is going to play out for the Republicans in Congress seeking re-election in 2018?
Okay, so I should say that my sense is completely informed by conversations I've had with political scientists, including Vanessa Williamson at Brookings, who was just brilliant. And yesterday she pointed out that people don't really understand income tax changes. I think the Republicans think that individuals are going to understand that this thing is helping them when their paychecks go up. She pointed out that after Obama cut taxes very significantly on low and middle income people as part of the stimulus package in 2009, voters thought he had raised their taxes. The Democrats are not going to feel any particular compulsion to explain to their voters how middle income people get higher paychecks as a result of this. And you know, the thing that was interesting about this bill is that the big things it did was it cut taxes on corporations, it cut taxes on high-income people. And based on polls, those are the two groups that most Americans think are not paying their fair share, that they should actually be paying more. So presumably the Democrats will be hitting on those issues. Right now, this tax cut is very unpopular, kind of historically unpopular compared with other tax, even some tax increase provisions. And part of that's probably tied to the president's unpopularity. But I think the Republicans did this because they felt like they had to do it for their base. They were getting a lot of pressure from their donors. But they have a big selling job going forward to explain to the broader American public why this is in their interest.
And thinking about 2020, and again, thinking about our recent political history, it's hard to remember a presidential candidate having success running in an open advocacy of raising taxes. But it seems like that's what's setting up, perhaps, that the Democratic presidential candidate will be pushing, in a sense, tax hikes. How do you see that, the likelihood of that, and how that might play out?
You know, if you look at the survey data, it looks like pushing for tax increases on corporations and on people with very high incomes, closing the carried interest loophole, maybe cutting back on the estate tax changes, those things could have wide support. You know, the Republicans on their side are just going to try to presumably play up the narrative that Democrats are tax and spend liberals who are, and even if the Democrats are targeting their tax increase proposals on people with very high incomes, that their opponents will say that this is going to raise taxes on middle-class people. It might be that the Democrats aren't going to say, that Democrats are not going to run on a platform of raising taxes per se, but that they will be talking about kinds of investment that they think have gotten short shrift, like You know, we still don't have an infrastructure program in place. You know, there might be an argument for making more investments in education and things like that. But I have to say, I'm an economist, and I'm probably the last person anybody should be looking to for political advice.
Well, I'm going to tap it one more time because we talked last week about the state and local tax deduction and the limitation on that, and then how that the effects that that might have at the state levels and the dynamic there. And I wanted to think about the politics there at the state level because that's one of the places, in addition to Congress and now the White House, where the Democrats in recent decades have really lost a lot of ground. And it's a concern for the Democratic Party looking at state houses and looking at state legislatures. In the most recent elections, they've had some victories. They've had some wins. And so how do you see the effects of this tax law in terms of how it would affect the spending at the state level? Because what the state now has to bear in mind in terms of what some of their citizens are going to feel through the federal tax code because of the state and local income tax deduction limitations, how's that going to change the politics at the state level, thinking about those races? That may be impossible to disentangle, but I wanted to get your sense of that because it's a big issue for thinking about how the country is governed.
It's not clear how much effect it's going to have on state policies. I really don't know the answer to the question about politics, but an interesting thing is in 1986, the sales tax was made non the Tax Reform Act of 86 eliminated the deduction for sales taxes.
I remember that. Yeah.
Many years later, it was reinstated. But there wasn't any shift at the state level to move away from sales taxes and in favor of income taxes or property taxes. It's a real, you know, I guess if you asked about silver linings on this bill. One is that it will produce some interesting data. It'll be interesting to see how the states respond. It might be that even though economists say that the cost of state government depends on the deductibility of state and local taxes, it might be that a lot of voters aren't really doing that calculus in their head, and they'll be just as amenable or hostile to state income taxes and property and local property taxes as they were before the bill. But it is an open question. You know, how it plays into state politics, I don't know. I'm in Virginia. I spend most of my time in Virginia, and it was pretty interesting to see how energized Democrats were in the last election, and there was
astonishing turnaround in the House of Delegates, and
astonishing turnaround.
came down to a name pulled out of a hat to see who was going to control the House. Yeah,
which I think is probably a metaphor for something about our current political system. But it was a complete shift. You know, this red state that all of a sudden had a basically 50-50 split in their House. We've got a Democratic governor. And a lot of dynamic young people decided they wanted to get involved in politics, and a surprising number of them actually won. I don't know whether that's part of a national trend. I don't know the extent to which this will be fueled by the tax bill or other things that people are concerned about. But you can imagine local legislators saying that a lot of responsibilities are going to be moved on to the state level and that you need a state government that's going to be more responsive than it has been in the past. And the interesting paradox in the United States is that although people say they don't like taxes, they actually do like a lot of the specific things the government provides. They do want to have roads that don't have giant holes in them and bridges that don't collapse and dams that don't fall apart. And they want education systems that are working. And state and local governments are what provide those things, and they're going to have to keep on doing it. And they're going to have more responsibilities for social welfare programs probably in the future than they have in the past.
That was Len Berman, and a reminder that you can find the first part of our conversation about the new tax law at WRVO.org. Len, thanks again for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.